You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. I'm opening up this episode a little different this week. We did not have a weekly worst, but there is a news story that I wanted to shine a light on. It's a story that happened last July that's getting headlines once again because of a subsequent lawsuit. But out of a Charleston County jail, lawyers say that a woman, 50 years old, of the name of Joyce Kernell, died behind bars. This is something that we've seen in cases such as Sandra Bland, is unfortunately all too common. But this one is particularly disturbing, as this woman was arrested for failing to pay certain fines and fees that were levied against her. We've talked about this on the show before. She didn't pay a court fine. And as a result, she was taken from the hospital in her town. She was put in jail, and for 27 hours, she was left behind bars, too sick to eat or call for help, didn't have water, didn't have food. Eventually, she was just given a trash bag from her her jailers for her to vomit in, and ultimately, she passed away behind bars. And this is something that is happening in the United States of America, the wealthiest nation on the earth. We are jailing people for failing to pay court fees and ultimately sentencing them to death. This is something that's horrible. Again, to say her name is Joyce Kernell. She was 50 years old. This was undoubtedly the weekly worst, and I wanted to make sure that that was on the radars of our listeners. We do, though, have a packed episode. We're going to be joined by my colleague and friend, Dr. Laura Durso of our LGBT team. We're also joined by reporter Josh Idelson of Bloomberg Businessweek, and they're going to be talking a bit about the discrimination against LGBT people in the workplace and recent lawsuits, particularly one against Walmart, that says that LGBT discrimination is sex discrimination because of the choice one makes in their partner, that falls under sex discrimination. So they're going to help us unpack what this means for our country, the implications of the lawsuit for the Civil Rights Act, and ways to change the law on the books overall. And we also have a fun segment. It is Oscars week. So we decided to dive into the Oscars So White controversy ourselves. In the past couple years, the Academy has failed to recognize any actors of color. Most notably, there's been award buzz around the movie Creed and Sylvester Stallone's role in this. But the director and star, both who are African-American, failed to get any recognition. We also know that the Straight Outta Compton cast was not even in invited to the Oscars. So this is something that's been in the news a lot, but a recent New York Times article pointed out that in the history of the Oscars, only 10 black women have been nominated for Best Actress, and 9 of them played characters who are homeless or soon to be homeless. The only exception was Viola Davis for her role in The Help, a role in which she played a maid. So we're going to talk to Jamil Smith of MTV News to try and understand why is it that the Academy feels most comfortable, it seems, recognizing black women specifically when they're playing roles in poverty, and what this has to say about how people perceive poverty and our culture as a whole. So stay tuned. We have a great episode.
Listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. It's Oscar time, and Woo! The awards ceremony comes and goes with great controversy this year. The hashtag OscarsSoWhite was born out of a widely shared frustration with the overwhelming whiteness of the nominees this year. This is actually the second time in a row where we've had an all-white nominee slate. And so we're going to dig a little deeper into what has caused some of this and what the Academy values in a black performance.
As a recent New York Times analysis that many of our listeners might have seen found, when it comes to black actresses in particular, it's only when portraying characters living in poverty that they get a shot at the Golden Statuette. So with us to discuss this is Jamil Smith. He's senior national correspondent at MTV News and also one of our favorite people on Twitter, Tracy and mine both. Jamil, thank you so much for joining us for Talk Poverty Radio.
Appreciate the opportunity.
And before, you know, we even started recording, we were talking about how it's great to hear your voice, that you're a real person.
Yes, I'm not a bot on the Twitters. No.
Yeah, it's not just...
You are good on the Twitters, yes. Though, even if you are a bot.
Yes.
Appreciate that.
So actually, yeah, before we forget, what's your Twitter handle so everyone can follow you?
Yes, at Jamil Smith. That's J-A-M-I-L-S-M-I-T-H.
And gotta get those promotions in there.
Yeah, gotta get those in. That's how you can become acquainted with him like we have.
No promises to our listeners, though. We want to keep them for ourselves. So, Jamil, we're really excited to have you on to talk about this because this has been something that has really gone viral in the social media world. It's been talked about in basically every news outlet. Oscars so white. This is really kind of what's dominating Oscar season this year, as it should be. And the outrage is really it's sort of wide ranging. But it spawned some really interesting conversations that delve farther and deeper than just into kind of the race of the people nominated. We mentioned at the top this New York Times piece, which we have to give a shout out to Brandon Thorpe, the reporter who did the analysis. Just to put some numbers to this, he looked at the nominations of black actors and black actresses over the history of the Academy Awards in the Best Actor and Best Actress categories, and he found that of the 10 black women who have ever been nominated for a Best Actress Award, all 10 of them played characters living in poverty, and 9 of them were either homeless or about to be homeless. Talk to us about what this means.
Well, I think that it tells you that audiences, mostly white audiences, value or at least view the black experience with a very, very narrow lens. So when they see a black woman, say Halle Berry in Monsters Ball, experiencing emotional trauma, experiencing poverty, experiencing abuse, experiencing tragedy, that is the version of blackness that they are most familiar with. When they see, black men like Forrest Whitaker and Denzel Washington playing evil, terrible black men who are violent, that's the version of black maleness that they understand. So when you're talking about an overwhelmingly white Academy voter base, older voter base, they have a very limited, apparently, vision of what black excellence, how black excellence can be exemplified on the screen. So if you're playing a, civil rights leader, or you're playing a businessman or businesswoman, that's not necessarily the same, value for them. That doesn't have the same value for them. But if you're playing a maid, that's something that they're familiar with. That's the kind of blackness that they've interacted with.
And there, another interesting dynamic that goes along with that is this kind of concept of a white savior, because I think we've seen in a lot of these movies where there's a struggle, but often the reason why this black character is able to escape their struggle is because of a white character. In the case of Precious, there was actually a spotlight on the fact that all of the negative characters were dark skin and the positive characters were light skin. So there's still some colorism involved, but usually there's a white savior dynamic. Do you think that plays into that same appeal to the audiences?
Oh, sure. And we have to also note that Precious was made, directed by a black man. So those kinds of color issues, those colorism issues, are present within the black filmmaking community. And so we can't just necessarily throw it all upon, white filmmakers and white Hollywood for, creating this environment. We need to understand how, the trauma has affected how we see ourselves as black people. So, we have to look at, this year's performances and understand, why they weren't necessarily recognized. Well, we have to understand, we're one of them was a movie about a rap group, a deeply misogynist, rap group with a lot of violent lyrics that, a lot of us grew up loving, but not really, maybe contextualizing all the you know, terrible things that they did. And so the film that, you know, tells their story, came under some criticism from some folks for being too, laudatory of their history. So when you think about, you know, what we're trying to put out there as far as imagery, I think the real, you know, complicated vision of blackness that you saw on the screen this year was in Creed, Ryan Coogler's film about the, you know, continuing the Rocky story. You saw North Philadelphia, a community with which I'm familiar with, having lived in the city for a long time. You saw North Philadelphia presented as authentically and as compassionately as possible. Not some color, airbrushed version of it, but, you know, you saw the gritty streets, you saw complicated black characters who were allowed to fear, allowed to be complicated, and you saw, you know, real character development and, you know, an excellent story. So when you see something like that go without recognition from the Oscars, it can be especially heartbreaking.
And actually, I want to read a quote that was at the end of the New York Times piece that we referenced, because a lot of the roles that black actors do get tend to be civil rights leaders or actors or actresses, musicians. They're these larger than life characters. So it seems like, well, they're getting good roles, but they aren't just your average black person in the U.S. And this professor who was interviewed for the piece, Dr. Petty, said, if you had a film about an ordinary black guy, well, then that might mean that he knows other black people, and those black people might need to be in the movie, and then it's a black film.
Heaven forbid, right?
Right, exactly. So I feel like it touches a little bit on what you were just saying about Michael B. Jordan's role in Creed. I mean, obviously a boxer isn't necessarily the average person, but it's a little more regular, I guess, compared to some of the other roles. Is there just, I guess it's hard for me to reconcile the fact that it did get attention from the Academy, or rather from the Golden Globes for Sylvester Stallone's performance, but that part got overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, I think Sylvester Stallone's performance is of a character, a classic character in American cinema that those Academy voters recognize. They know that guy. They understand that guy. They don't know Adonis Johnson, later Adonis Creed in the film. They don't know that kid. They don't know his struggles. They don't understand a young, educated black man with a lot of, you know, emotional troubles who was, you know, finding his way in boxing and needs the mentorship of Rocky Balboa. They don't understand that kid. They don't understand the young woman who he encounters, who is, you know, hearing impaired, but she's a singer and she's got a lot of complications. Philly girl, does, you know, says John a lot. They're like, you know what I mean? This is stuff that, like, they don't understand. They're not familiar with that reality. And we cannot allow Hollywood's primary measure for success beyond financial figures, the Oscars, to continue to ignore the complicated black realities that are out here. I mean, these films are out here. Dope is just another example of a complicated black reality with which white audiences are unfamiliar. Now, we can have a conversation about the merits of the film and whether or not some people liked it, some people didn't. But the point is that you have films like this out here representing black reality, and they're going unrecognized. Now, this is not new by any stretch. I mean, in 1989, you had Do the Right Thing go unnominated in the same year that Driving Miss Daisy wins Best Picture. You have 1996, a protest by Jesse Jackson organized around the overall whiteness of the Oscars. You had, a movie like Crash, which represents a very distorted, terribly truncated version of racial realities in this country, winning Best Picture, a decade ago. So this is not new. It's not unexpected. However, it just because we're not surprised by something doesn't mean that we shouldn't be more impassioned about it. And I credit the Twitter user known as Rain of April, at Rain of April, young black woman, for starting this hashtag, and because I think awareness has its own power. People just becoming aware and saying, wait a minute, yeah, that is kind of messed up that they haven't had a black, or forget about black, a person of color nominated in the acting categories for 2 years. it says a lot about what about how we sort of let this kind of stuff continue, you know, via our own apathy. If we continue to make this a primary issue, representation of our stories, Black, Latino, Asian, all different minorities, we will hopefully, you know, get through to people and hopefully create some financial consequences, because we all know that's what Hollywood cares about the most.
Jamil, I have to say, hearing you say the word John is just music to my ears, given that now I know why I like you so much. I'm a former Philadelphian too, right? We can do some John later.
There we go.
So, but you know, just to unpack a little bit of what you just said, right? I think, you know, just to play devil's advocate, is it the Academy who is to blame here? I mean, it's not the one making the casting decisions, is something that some people have argued as we've had this national conversations. Are the Oscars a symptom of a deeper problem of racial representation that really lies with Hollywood?
I wouldn't necessarily call it a symptom, because I think that devoids the Academy from the agency of actually choosing the nominees that they're choosing amidst a field of certainly more diverse films than I think Hollywood has given credit for. There are roles out here. There aren't enough by any stretch, but there are roles, excellent roles, for people of color to be playing. And I certainly think that a lot of these good performances, like Michael B. Jordan's and others, are going unrecognized. That said, the Oscars is a micro version of the macro problem that Hollywood is suffering from. And it's a problem that isn't limited to Hollywood. As you saw in the New York Times feature this week, which actors of color and women were recounting awful stories of discrimination and erasure that they've experienced over the course of their careers. This is stuff that resonates in the journalism business. This is stuff that resonates in corporate America. This is stuff that resonates in various arenas throughout American life. And I think there's a lot of stuff that we can look at, you know, and see and say, wow, you know, I know what it's like to be the only one in the room. And it's not necessarily about being an actor. It's not necessarily being about the only one in the film. These are experiences that are universal. And what we need to do is take from this debate is not simply say, like, okay, well, this is just a Hollywood problem. No, this is this has an even larger scope beyond California. It is a worldwide issue. And I think what we, you know, the sooner we get a grasp on, you know, how big this problem is and how it relates to all of us, I think the sooner we'll be able to address it properly.
And with regard to, though, the images of characters in particular and why this is important, you know, in reading about the Oscars and thinking through the dynamics at play here, I've thought about how multiple politicians, including Vice President Biden, cited Will and Grace as helping push their thinking on gay marriage. And so mm-hmm. I'd be curious to hear if you think that Hollywood, if we're able to have more, I guess, dynamic characters for communities of color in the time of Black Lives Matter and racial justice taking a center stage at even the presidential campaign, do you feel like film and television still has the power to help push more of racial justice or social justice agenda?
Yes. I mean, I think we saw just a few days ago with the example of Black-ish, their episode concentrating on police brutality and not just, you know, depicting it or talking about the fact that it's happening, but helping bring white audiences and audiences of other colors into a Black living room to understand how Black families discuss this, from the smallest children to the oldest adults in the house. Everybody was involved. Everybody had different perspectives on the problem. And I think it was a very nuanced and complicated show. And I think that more, you know, you don't have to have a very special episode of every sitcom in order to keep educating white people or about experiences that people of color go through.
That sounds fantastic, though.
It sounds like an SNL sketch waiting to be made.
But I think that, you know, shows like Black-ish are proving the power of representation for at least people of color. Certainly you see that also with, you know, shows featuring complicated stories about women. I mean, you know, that's another thing we need to really understand. It's like, yes, I mean, the fact that, you know, there are best actor and best actress and supporting actor and actress categories mandate that there are going to be five women nominated for actress, but five women nominated for supporting actress. But what kind of roles are women still getting? And I think that that's something that needs to be also examined. So we need to, you know, understand what kind of roles that, you know, that we're giving to. You got a film like The Revenant, you know, you have a, you know, okay, wow, we authentic sort of, you know, I guess you're debating authentic representations of Native American culture in that film. Can we get more of those? Like, can we get more of what modern Native American life is like? So, I mean, this is a bigger problem than just, you know, Black Americans not getting the representation that we need. There's so many different communities out here that are not being seen for the, you know, for all the, you know, all the layers that they have. And I think that, you know, hopefully this debate can bring some attention to that. Not just attention, but, you know, some consequences as well.
And of course, it isn't just about casting people, right? We saw with the X-Files revival, Gillian Anderson came out and made public the gender pay gap in Hollywood as well. That she was being paid just a fraction of what David Duchovny playing Fox Mulder was being paid in the revival. But I want to dig into something that you just brought up, which is sort of what does it mean to be adequately representing people and communities in film and in this industry, that, you know, there's been discussion that it isn't about just casting people and getting them on screen, that that's not enough, that rather than just checking the box because you've got X number of Black people in a film, what you need to do is actually have a broader, kind of more meaningful test. The New York Times film critic Manola Dargis proposed a test that she calls the DuVernay test. She named it for Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma, one of Hollywood's leading Black directors. And of course, this builds on the Bechdel test about women. Tell us a little bit about what that test would push us to look for and how that might tie into what you brought up with economic consequences.
Well, the DuVernay test, which, you know, I thought it was, you know, brilliantly named for a wonderful director. Essentially, the DuVernay test is, you know, if you have a Black character in the film, that character cannot simply be there to revolve purely in a white universe. That Black character has to, you know, require, you know, African Americans to, you know, have fully realized layered stories. And so, and you can't just be, you know, the Black friend in the background. You can't just be the Black ex girlfriend who, you know, pops up in one scene. You know, these characters have to have layered and complicated stories that involve more than just white people. And I think that, you know, if you're going to go forward and try to actually improve Hollywood, I think that that's a good place to start. So it just remains to be seen whether or not casting directors and studio executives primarily, and this is the key point, whether the people making the actual decisions regarding the finances of a film care enough about these kinds of tests. Can the sufficient pressure be put on the studios using this quantitative analysis to, you know, force some change and make the, you know, these studios listen, you know, if not to the voices calling out, at least to our pocketbooks.
So in the last moments that we have with you, I wanted to bring up the fact that Ava DuVernay, amongst other prominent Black entertainers, including the director of Creed, Ryan Coogler, they're going to be in Flint holding a Justice for Flint event rather than attending the Oscars. They said it's because it's the last day of Black History Month and they want to bring more awareness to the situation in Flint. Just in the, you know, 10 seconds that you have left with us, what are your reactions to this event?
Yes, I think it's a wonderful event. I think it's a great idea. And I think I was on a conference call with Ryan Coogler and some of the other organizers, and they made it clear that this was not a rebuke to the Oscars. It is, to me, a pure, the purest expression of what entertainment is supposed to be for. It's supposed to be lifting people's spirits. It's supposed to take us out of our daily doldrums, and it's supposed to, you know, in certain instances, be used for social good. And so, basically, what you have here is a bunch of entertainers: Janelle Monáe, Ava DuVernay, Jesse Williams from Grey's Anatomy, and Ladisi, a number of other entertainers, Robert Glasper, going to Flint and entertaining the Flint audience, entertaining people from Flint, and saying, like, this is what we want to bring to you. We want to bring our entertaining talents, our skills to you, so we can help lift your spirits, give you a moment of escape. And to me, that, more than the Oscars, is what entertainment should really be about.
Jamil Smith, senior national correspondent with MTV News. This has been a lot of fun for me. I won't speak for Tracy, but she's nodding.
We're gonna, Tracy, not so much.
Maybe not Tracy, but you know,
this has been fantastic.
She's got her own John, but we'll have to have you back on soon.
Yes, please.
All right. Thank you very much.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. Is anti-gay discrimination a form of sex discrimination? This is the question at the heart of a lawsuit against Walmart for failing to provide health benefits to same-sex partners of employees. The case against Walmart could help set a precedent by expanding the definition of sex discrimination and extend further protections to LGBT people.
To discuss this, we're joined by Josh Idelson, a reporter with Bloomberg Businessweek, who recently wrote about the case, as well as our colleague Dr. Laura Durso. I got doctor in there for you. Director of CAPS LGBT Research and Communications Project. Thank you to you both for being here with us for this segment.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Laura, before we go into any details on this specific Walmart case, can you help us get a better understanding of what legal protections currently exist for LGBT people and other minority groups and sort of how this fits into the broader legal landscape?
Sure. It's actually a really great question, because if you ask Americans, the majority of them believe that it's already illegal to discriminate against LGBT Americans. So that would be on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. When in fact, despite our marriage equality win at the Supreme Court last year, there remains no explicit statutory protections for LGBT Americans. What do I mean by that? Well, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 includes protections for things like employment, public accommodations, and includes things like jury service that we don't even think about, ways that we participate in public life. And up until this point in time, there is no protection explicitly for sexual orientation or for gender identity. So something like Title VII, which is the employment title of the Civil Rights Act, it includes sex, race, color, national origin, and religion. And that's where this gets interesting, as Josh, I'm sure, will talk about with this case, because it does cover sex discrimination. And so we have this really interesting moment in time where we are advancing LGBT equality in the courts, and we're also trying to advance it in state legislatures and in Congress. So that's sort of the landscape that we're working with right now. there do exist a few extra protections, I think that's important to make note of. So there is something called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and it has ruled that LGBT Americans, at least in the employment context, have protections. So they are taking complaints on the basis of sexual orientation-based discrimination or gender identity-based discrimination. So there do exist some protections in the employment context. The president also signed an executive order that protects people who work for federal contractors. So they are also taking complaints if you work for a federal contractor and you're discriminated against, which could mean being fired or being refused employment on the basis of your LGBT status. So there's a few things that are protected, but as we know, discrimination against LGBT Americans is not just happening in the 9-to-5 workday.
So that leads nicely into a question that I have. So with the Walmart case, it surrounds health benefits being denied to same-sex partners. Can you go into a little bit of detail about how LGBT people are commonly discriminated against in the workplace?
Absolutely. Well, it's sort of a sad fact that discrimination still exists in our society, and not just on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. But in the workplace, this can range from outright being fired or not hired, as I mentioned, but there's other ways that people can discriminate against each other in the workplace, and that can range from sort of seemingly innocuous comments, more sort of harassment type experiences that might be in the workplace. Some, I'm sure, might argue that there's actually a wage gap that exists, not just for women, but for LGBT people as well, and that in and of itself is a form of discrimination. And so that's sort of what it looks like in the employment context. And we would certainly argue that the fact that there are no statutory protections for LGBT Americans is in and of itself a form of discrimination as well. And that's sort of the systemic institutional discrimination.
So, Josh, I want to bring you into this conversation. You wrote an article for Business Week recently covering the Walmart case that we mentioned at the top. What's going on in this case? What's at stake? What do we need to be watching here?
Sure. So up until the beginning of 2014, when Walmart changed its policy, the policy at Walmart, the largest employer in the United States, was that spousal benefits were available to employees with an opposite sex spouse, but not to employees with a same sex spouse. So if you were a man with a wife who qualified, you could put your wife on your health plan. If you were a woman with a wife, you couldn't, and vice versa. This is a lawsuit that was brought after the EEOC, the agency that Laura mentioned, concluded that there was reasonable cause to think that Walmart had violated the Civil Rights Act. Now, as Laura said, there is nothing in the Civil Rights Act that explicitly mentions sexual orientation. And so this lawsuit is alleging sex discrimination. And it's actually an interesting example within a larger pantheon of lawsuits that have come forward over the past several years, particularly since the EEOC has shown sympathy and more recently explicitly endorsed this legal theory, the theory being that when someone is discriminated against for being gay, that is a form of sex discrimination for a few reasons.
So to help us put a face on how this plays out, what are the kind of human consequences of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, tell us about the named plaintiff in this case, Jackie Coate.
Yes. So the named plaintiff, Jackie Coate, has worked at Walmart since 1999. She, in Massachusetts, married her wife, Diana Smithson, who, in fact, also worked for many years at Walmart, but left the workforce to take care of Jackie's mother. Diana Smithson was a breast cancer survivor and, in 2012, was diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer. And so in that 2012 to 2013 period, before Walmart changed its policy, the couple, Jackie and Diana, racked up over $150,000, they say, in medical bills. And Jackie describes having repeatedly, using Walmart's website and over the phone, tried to add Diana to her policy and clicking the box. And when on the website, she tried to put in that she was a woman and her spouse was a woman, getting essentially an error message that she had to call HR. And this surprised her, she told me, because she was legally married, like many other Walmart employees, in the state where she got married and in the state where she worked. And so there is a class that lawyers estimate maybe over 1,200 people who currently or formerly work at Walmart who were in same-sex marriages and could have gotten the benefits potentially but didn't because their spouse was of the same sex rather than the opposite sex.
And so a quote from one of the lawyers that's involved in this litigation, which I feel like sort of sums up the heart of this case, right, is the sex of her spouse is the reason for treating people differently. Isn't that discrimination based on sex? And Laura, to bring you back in, do you find this kind of using sex discrimination as the way in to protect folks based on sexual orientation, is it a gimmick, or do you think that this makes sense?
Well, as Josh said, we've been having increasing levels of success in making this argument, and I don't work for a litigation group, but we've really been trying to put forth a very, very simple argument, which I think Josh put perfectly, which is if you're a man with a wife, we're expecting you and we'll treat you, to do certain things and we'll treat you in certain ways. But if you're a woman with a wife, then we're not. And I think that really just brings it to a very, very basic level, which is that gender matters. Like, we can't talk about it without talking about gender. So I definitely don't think it's a gimmick. I think, sort of two key points. One is we've had a ton of success making the argument that gender identity-based discrimination is a form of sex discrimination. So that's not really an issue in this particular case, but I think it is really important to note that we've made that strong argument. The EEOC has certainly supported us for many years now at this point in having those protections in place, and we've seen less success on the sexual orientation side, which I think is really, really interesting. And that sort of brings us to one of the places that we're in now, which is with the Supreme Court vacancy. And so while we've seen success in the courts, really until the Supreme Court rules on this kind of an issue, we're not going to know just exactly how far we can take this theory and how far we can get these protections.
And before we get to, I guess, some of the long-term strategies about how to protect LGBT people, I wanted to bring in, I guess, Walmart for a second and what their side of this argument is. So they deny that they did any wrongdoing, that it was essentially an overlook. And so their PR person, Randy Hargrove, said, before the lawsuit was filed, we attempted to resolve it, and we've said we remain open to further discussions. This seems to fall into the disparate impact discussions that we've had. Maybe they didn't intend to discriminate, but however their procedures are, they ultimately did. Will this hold up in court with this particular subject matter? I'll start with you, Josh, since I'm quoting something out of your article.
So, I would have liked to hear in more depth from Walmart what their argument is for why they have not violated the Civil Rights Act. And Walmart was not interested in showing their card, so to speak, in that way. They did say that they believe their policy was legal, the policy that they had up until 2014. Others, I talked, for example, to Richard Epstein, the libertarian law professor who is a critic of anti-discrimination law generally, who made the argument that you would expect conservatives to make, which is this is a bridge too far. This is essentially reverse engineering where there's something that advocates want and then they try to find it somewhere in the law and it's not what Congress intended. Now, the advocates, of course, would and do respond that it doesn't really matter what Congress intended if the plain meaning of the law includes LGBT people. And in fact, they look to a unanimous opinion from none other than Justice Scalia in a case called On Call, which involved same-sex sexual harassment, where the Supreme Court said, again, unanimously, it doesn't really matter whether Congress intended, whether Congress was thinking about a man sexually harassing another man when it wrote the Civil Rights Act, if the plain language clearly includes that situation. In terms of the calculation that Walmart has going forward, there was mediation in the case last Monday. There has not been comment from either side about what happened there. The case is scheduled for November. Certainly, Walmart has tremendous legal and financial resources if it chose to fight this, but also a real reputational risk if it continues to.
Well, and to actually look at the other side of the coin, is there also potentially a real opportunity here, depending on how Walmart decides to proceed? If they were to take the option of settling the case and of stating, we recognize sexual orientation being part of the Civil Rights Act, would that have maybe not precedential value in the legal sense, but ripple effects in terms of what other employers do or need to do?
Yeah, that's the view of several of the advocates I talked to, is that unlike cases that are not class actions and cases that don't involve a brand name like Walmart, a settlement from Walmart, whether if Walmart explicitly took the position you're talking about or even implicitly by forking over money to a class of maybe 1,200 people, could have a real ripple effect in that other plaintiffs, attorneys, other companies, knowing that Walmart knows what it's doing and had the resources to fight it, would take a message from the fact that this argument was able to at least lead to a settlement. And the argument here actually is a trio of arguments. It's an argument based on sex stereotyping, that treating gay people differently is discrimination based on sex stereotypes, which the Supreme Court said is a form of sex discrimination. It's what you were referring to, the facial classification argument, that this is a rule where the sex of the people involved determines the result. And then third, there is a argument here that is that basically that this is a form of associational discrimination, just as exists in the race discrimination context of treating someone differently for associating a certain way with a man rather than with a woman.
And Laura, you started to get into, I guess, the fact that we've used the courts as a strategy for a long time, and the direction of your conversation sounded like you have some ideas on what could be done next. You know, Josh referred to the interpretation of the laws on books. I know that you're doing some work to change the laws on books. Can you explain what, I guess, is a next step for LGBT anti-discrimination work?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I want to underscore the point that, you know, this is a sound legal theory that we've seen success, and we want to continue to see success in the courts in this way, and not just in employment, but in other places where sex discrimination protections exist. So, for example, you know, we know that there are significant health disparities that the LGBT community experiences relative to their non-LGBT peers. So, fortunately, the Affordable Care Act has protections, pretty robust protections within it that are meant to try and get at addressing some of these disparities. And so we're making that very same argument in the context of healthcare, saying you're not allowed to discriminate, you know, in healthcare on the basis of sex. And that includes not discriminating against LGBT Americans. And so, you know, again, want to underscore that point that, you know, we have plenty of places to go here where sex discrimination protections exist. I think the key point to make, though, is that we are then unfortunately limited by only being able to obtain protections where sex discrimination protections exist. And unfortunately, that's not in every place in the law. I'll point to one particular example, which is we don't have sex discrimination protections in public accommodations. So these are entities that, businesses that open their doors to the public, serve the public marketplace. So we can't actually sue our way to protections in public accommodations. We have to go get them. And so that's why a piece of legislation like the Equality Act at the federal level, various state laws that are being proposed include protections across the spectrum. So again, we recognize that discrimination doesn't begin and end in the 9-to-5 workday. The ability to get and keep a job means you've had access to a really good education. It means you have a safe and stable place to lay your head at night. And so we want to make sure that LGBT Americans are protected in all areas of life. The Equality Act would do that. It adds sexual orientation and gender identity protections, but crucially, it also adds sex discrimination protections in Title II, which is that public accommodations piece. It also adds it in federal funding, which is not a place where it currently exists in law. So we really need this multi-pronged approach, or we're not going to address the full scope of discrimination.
So I want to take a step back and maybe be unpopular for a second and play devil's advocate.
Sounds very fun.
We all love you.
So why... Some of our listeners might be wondering, why does the government have a role to play in curbing discrimination, right? I mean, sort of stepping back and actually questioning the premise of discrimination as being a negative thing per se. Why does the government have a role to play here, and why is this something, particularly in the sexual orientation realm, where curbing it is something that we think should be part of the role of government? Do you have any thoughts on that, Laura?
Sure. I mean, I think you could look at anti-discrimination law as simply a means of punishing bad actors. So we want to, persuade people that it's wrong to treat their neighbors, inappropriately or with malice. And so the government has an interest in sort of punishing bad people. I think that's sort of a limited view of the way we should think about why the government has an interest in having laws that protect people from discrimination. And I think it's that the government has an interest in the health and well-being of its communities, and that we recognize that everybody should have a right to, a free and open marketplace and good schools and, you know, living in vibrant communities that have nothing to do with various characteristics. So where you're coming from, what the color of your skin is, what language you speak, what religion you decide to practice on a Saturday or Sunday. And so I think the government has that interest in supporting its citizens. And I think we see the benefits of non-discrimination, which we don't often talk about. So we know that in the LGBT context, I'll sort of stick with for a second, that discrimination has really significant health impacts. So this is not just mental health, which I think people probably kind of connect with pretty easily, but there's a long set of scientific findings now linking up the experiences of discrimination to poor mental health. It also has physical health impacts. I mean, can you imagine sort of being in the closet as a kid and the toll that that might take on you? Or, you know, to be frank, the like very real needing to come out on a daily basis to people you've never met before, what stress that might be, or, you know, moving to a new city, being in a cab with a taxi driver that you don't know what they're going to think when you say, well, what are you doing here for work? And you're there for the LGBT conference and you don't want to say things. And so, you know, there's these sort of cumulative stressful effects that LGBT people and really anyone experiencing discrimination would affect. And that affects your long-term health. That affects your ability to build support networks within your community. And I think the government has an interest in making sure that its citizens are healthy, that they are connected to support systems within their communities and can engage in a marketplace that we need to work for everybody. And so we know that workplaces with LGBT supportive policies, they have workers who don't turn over as quickly. They have people who are more productive and engaged in their workplaces. And so I think that's, to come back around, I think that's sort of why government cares at all, because it means that the world is going to work the way that it should, and everybody can freely participate in that, not just that we want to punish a few bad actors.
And something that comes up a lot in these conversations relates to religious liberty. Josh, you looked at a lot of different cases for your piece, and I'm wondering what the implications of religious liberty and people saying that they want to, they're just discriminating based off of the tenets of their religion, how that plays into, the effort to expand LGBT rights.
This is something that is going to continue to be a lightning rod. Even one of the areas where there is protection for LGBT employees is in the federal workforce, and the government contracting executive order that President Obama has added LGBT status to includes a line about contractors being able to hire people of their own religion, and advocacy groups have asked whether a discriminatory contractor might be able to argue that someone who is a practicing LGBT person in and of that, by the employer's definition, can't be a person of their religion. So there's potential controversy to be had there. In the case of the Equality Act, and prior to that, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which was more employment-focused, one in a series of real heartfelt debates within the LGBT advocacy community was around this question of how much of a religious exemption is justifiable. And so in the same way that we in the past had controversy about whether to do a LGB ENDA bill that left out transgender people. In the last Congress, there was controversy about whether a broader of religious exemption is acceptable for employment protection for LGBT people than the one that exists in the Civil Rights Act for categories like race. And then similarly, we see at the state level these efforts to push bills in places like Arkansas that would create a defense for companies or individuals, depending on the legislation, acting based on their view of their practice of their religion. And so, of course, the part of what makes those bills so controversial is the idea that when you heighten the burden for government to restrict somebody, if somebody's acting on their religion, then that has the effect of shielding people who act intentionally to exclude LGBT people.
And Laura, same question. Do you have any thoughts about the role of religion will play?
Sure. I mean, this has been a really contentious debate. Josh is completely right. And, you know, I do want to make clear that the advancement of LGBT equality is not a retrenchment of protections that exist in this country for religious freedom. The country has a long tradition of upholding religious freedom. And that right is not being infringed when we talk about expanding protections for LGBT Americans. And really where we landed with the Equality Act, speaking about this debate about where are we going to, you know, end up and what kinds of protections and sort of who gets to opt out. You know, the principle that we really put forward with the Equality Act is LGBT Americans should be treated just like all other Americans, and that there's an existing framework in this country for combating discrimination and for allowing for the free expression of religion, the ability to hire co-religionists, as Josh was talking about, and that we think that's a framework that can and should work for everybody. And so the Equality Act, in amending the Civil Rights Act, which I'll note is something that the president supports, and I think Walmart and others sort of saying that this is kind of the right thing to do, you know, having these sex discrimination protections and including LGBT Americans underneath them, that we're just sort of asking to be included within that framework. We're not making any changes. There is an exemption in Title VII for that same kind of idea, which is you can hire somebody of the same religion, and that's perfectly allowed. And so we just want the sort of the dignity that comes with those exact same protections, no more and no less.
And your team actually released a really interesting video recently that called into question the lines between religion and discrimination. Could you share briefly with us the story of this family and also where we can find the video for viewers interested?
Sure. Please go to AmericanProgress.org and check out all of our resources and our great videos.
This is the shilling portion of the program. We'll let you, Josh, talk about Business Week and where people can find your article in just a little bit.
Follow us at LGBT Progress. So we met a couple, John and Jerry, who live in Richmond, Virginia. And John was hired as the executive director of a senior living facility in Richmond. And the sort of key component of this is that it was owned by the Diocese of Richmond. He was hired as the executive director. All of his work responsibilities were very clearly secular. And, you know, sort of his job was fundraising and various other components of kind of keeping the shop running. I think he was only 5 or 8 days into his job when it became known that he had a husband. And the diocese came knocking, and he thought it was to welcome him to the position. Everyone had been great. He was very excited to have started. They were going to have a welcoming reception, I think, and dance. And he thought that they were coming to welcome him to this new position. They summarily fired him on the spot without any explanation. They had sort of asked him, we hear you have a husband, you're in a same-sex marriage, you know, and that's not okay, and we're firing you. And it, you know, it really brings to light this entire debate, which is sort of who's a minister and who's doing a secular job and sort of whose right is it to tell you, you know, sort of who you can and cannot marry. And are we sort of OK as a society with saying, well, that was OK, despite the fact that it caused significant strife, financial instability, you know, for this particular couple, you know, just it was a really devastating blow. He was fortunately supported by members of the board of directors who resigned in protest after he was fired. And he has the backing at the moment. He's filed a complaint with the EEOC. And so we're fortunate that, at least in this case, there's recourse for this family. But we know not everyone has access to those kinds of things. And so one of the things we really do need to do is to make sure that people know what rights are available to them and work to expand those rights and make sure that people sort of can't opt out of laws that they don't like and don't like them specifically for LGBT people. And again, I think that's kind of the key piece here with the religious sort of freedom and religious exemption debate, which is we just want to be treated like everyone else. You sort of make your argument about why LGBT people should be treated differently. Why shouldn't we bake the cake? And I think you have to, the burden should be on, these sort of religiously affiliated entities or even individuals to sort of make the case why LGBT people should be treated differently than everyone else.
Well, so, I mean, building off of that, right, the wanting to be treated like everyone else, I think following and in the run-up to last year's landmark Supreme Court decision declaring marriage equality the law of the land, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not a culture shift had taken place in terms of how gay people are viewed in this country, whether it's, you know, an us versus a them. And I'm curious to hear both of you talk about your views on whether that will come into play as we see this continued litigation as well as advocacy, but litigation in particular around discrimination in the workplace and elsewhere. Josh, you first.
Sure. So I think it's inarguable looking through history that courts are partially influenced by public attitudes on the law and on the set of issues that are going to be impacted by the law. And so the prospect that the Supreme Court could embrace the argument, particularly with a new justice, that treating someone differently because they are gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender is a way of treating them differently based on sex, that prospect exists because public attitudes are in the place they are and not the place they were a few decades ago. And in fact, versions of that argument were made and rejected in most of the federal appeals courts in the United States over the past century. The reason that we start to see the decisions change is in part because we see public attitudes change. And it's interesting that in what Chai Feldblum, the EEOC commissioner, refers to as this race taking place now between Congress and the courts to establish this right, that we see two institutions that each are in some way influenced by public opinion, but also have some structural forces that insulate them from what the majority of people in the United States might want.
And of course, Chaya Feldblum, a member of the EEOC, also one of my favorite humans. I should get on the record. I love her. And she's worth following on Twitter. She's very snarky. But Laura, same question to you about culture shift.
Sure. I mean, as we're saying, it is undoubtedly true that hearts and minds were changed in the marriage equality debate. You can look at political science to tell you that that's true. But I think everyone sort of feels that there was the shift in understanding who same-sex couples were, the reasons that they wanted to be married. We saw initially in the debate around marriage, people talked a lot about rights and responsibilities. But what really worked was talking about love and commitment and sort of why people get married, because everyone kind of connects with these ideas and these values. And so I think it's undoubtedly true that helped us with the marriage equality debate. I think sort of two points to make around why this matters and sort of where it's actually falling down a little bit. One thing is if we can't sue our way to all of the rights that we need, then we actually have to get people to act. And that's where culture shift is going to be so hugely important, because we have to get a critical mass of individuals who say discrimination is wrong, the government needs to do something about it. And to hold my government accountable, I need to elect officials who believe the way that I do. We're fortunate that a majority of Americans think that it should be illegal to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. But we need to hold elected officials accountable to this idea of equality. So a cultural shift will help us to do that, which is to get people to vote, really. And I think one of the places that we're seeing that challenge play out right now is with the just truly terrible set of anti-transgender bills that are popping up across the country. We are waiting on the governor of South Dakota to decide to sign, veto, or let become law a bill that would basically mean that transgender children in schools have to show their birth certificate, may have to prove their gender, and they can't use the restroom that is in accordance with their gender identity. We're seeing this all over the country. And one of the reasons that we are really struggling right now is because only around 10% of Americans say that they know someone who is transgender. It's probably more than that because not all trans people are out. But it is really a place where we haven't had the same kind of culture shift on understanding who transgender people are, what issues they face, what needs they have. And that's a place where we really need to, you know, double, triple, quadruple our efforts to shifting the culture and making sure that people truly understand why trans people are so in need of these types of protections and why these bills are so truly horrible.
So Laura Durso is the director of LGBT Progress here at the Center for American Progress. Josh Idelson is a reporter, one of our favorite reporters, at Bloomberg Businessweek. You can find his article. It's called The Walmart Case That Could Expand Gay Rights at Work at Bloomberg.com. And you can find him at Josh Idelson. And you can find Laura Durso at The Durso Is In. Thank you both for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week. I work and get paid like minimum.